more purposeful, thoughtful, and focused than this sort of naive practice. In particular, it has the following characteristics. Purposeful practice has well-defined, specific goals. Our hypothetical music student would have been much more successful with a practice goal something like this. Play the piece all the way through at the proper speed without a mistake 3 times in a row. Without such a goal, there was no way to judge whether the practice session had been a success. In Steve's case, there was no long-range goal because none of us knew how many digits one could possibly memorize. But he had a very specific short-term goal, to remember more digits than he had the previous session. As a distance runner, Steve was very competitive, even if he was only competing with himself, and he brought that attitude to the experiment. From the very beginning, Steve was pushing each day to increase the number of digits he could remember. Purposeful practice is all about putting a bunch of baby steps together to reach a longer-term goal. If you're a weekend golfer and you want to decrease your handicap by 5 strokes, that's fine for an overall purpose, but it is not a well-defined, specific goal that can be used effectively for your practice. Break it down and make a plan. What exactly do you need to do to slice 5 strokes off your handicap? One goal might be to increase the number of drives landing in the fairway. That's a reasonably specific goal. But you need to break it down even more. What exactly will you do to increase the number of successful drives? You will need to figure out why so many of your drives are not landing in the fairway and address that by, for instance, working to reduce your tendency to hook the ball. How do you do that? An instructor can give you advice on how to change your swing motion in specific ways, and so on. The key thing is to take that general goal, get better, and turn it into something specific that you can work on with a realistic expectation of improvement. Purposeful practice is focused. Unlike the music student that Wary described, Steve Falloon was focused on his task from the very beginning, and his focus grew as the experiment went along and he was memorizing longer and longer strings of digits. You can get a sense of this focus by listening to the tape of session 115, which came about halfway through the study. Steve had regularly been remembering strings of close to 40 digits, but 40 itself was not something he could do yet with any consistency, and he really wanted to reach 40 regularly on this day. We began with 35 digits, which was easy for him, and he started pumping himself up as the strings increased in length. Before I read the 39-digit string, he gave himself an excited pep talk, seemingly conscious of nothing but the approaching task. "We have a big day here. I haven't missed one yet, have I? Nope. This will be a banner day." He was silent during the 40 seconds it took me to read out the numbers, but then, as he carefully went over the digits in his head, remembering various groups of them and the order in which they appeared, he could barely contain himself. He hit the table loudly a number of times, and he clapped a lot, apparently in celebration of remembering this or that group of digits, or where they went in the string. Once he blurted out, "Absolutely right, I'm certain." And when he finally spit the digits back at me, he was indeed right. So we moved on to 40. Again, the pep talk. "Now, this is the big one. If I get past this one, it's all over. I have to get past this one." Again, the silence as I read the digits, and then the excited noises and exclamations as he cogitated. "Wow, come on now. All right, go." He got that one right as well, and the session indeed became one in which he regularly hit 40 digits, although no more. Now, not everyone will focus by hollering and pounding on the table, but Steve's performance illustrates a key insight from the study of effective practice. You seldom improve much without giving the task your full attention. Purposeful practice involves feedback. You have to know whether you were doing something right, and if not, how you're going wrong. In Wary's example, the music student got belated feedback at school with a C on the performance test. But there seems to have been no feedback during practice. No one listening and pointing out mistakes, with the student seemingly clueless about whether there were errors in the practice. "How many times did you play it correctly?" I don't know, once or twice. In our memory study, Steve got simple, direct feedback after every attempt, correct or incorrect, success or failure. He always knew where he stood. But perhaps the most important feedback was something that he did himself. He paid close attention to which aspects of a string of digits caused him problems. If he'd gotten the string wrong, he usually knew exactly why and which digits he had messed up on. Even if he got the string correct, he could report to me afterward which digits had given him trouble and which had been no problem. By recognizing where his weaknesses were, he could switch his focus appropriately and come up with new memorization techniques that would address those weaknesses. Generally speaking, no matter what you're trying to do, you need feedback to identify exactly where and how you are falling short. Without feedback, either from yourself or from outside observers, you cannot figure out what you need to improve on or how close you are to achieving your goals. Purposeful practice requires getting out of one's comfort zone. This is perhaps the most important part of purposeful practice. Wary's music student shows no sign of ever pushing himself beyond what was familiar and comfortable. Instead, the student's words seem to imply a rather desultory attempt at practice, with no effort to do more than what was already easy for him. That approach just doesn't work. Our memory experiment was set up to keep Steve from getting too comfortable. As he increased his memory capacity, I would challenge him with longer and longer strings of digits so that he was always close to his capacity. In particular, by increasing the number of digits each time he got a string right and decreasing the number when he got it wrong, I kept the number of digits right around what he was capable of doing, while always pushing him to remember just one more digit. This is a fundamental truth about any sort of practice. If you never push yourself beyond your comfort zone, you will never improve. The amateur pianist who took half a dozen years of lessons when he was a teenager, but who for the past 30 years has been playing the same set of songs in exactly the same way over and over again, may have accumulated 10,000 hours of practice during that time. But he is no better at playing the piano than he was 30 years ago. Indeed, he's probably gotten worse. We have especially strong evidence of this phenomenon as it applies to physicians. Research on many specialties shows that doctors who have been in practice for 20 or 30 years do worse on certain objective measures of performance than those who are just 2 or 3 years out of medical school. It turns out that most of what doctors do in their day-to-day practice does nothing to improve or even maintain their abilities. Little of it challenges them or pushes them out of their comfort zones. For that reason, I participated in a consensus conference in 2015 to identify new types of continuing medical education that will challenge doctors and help them maintain and improve their skills. We will discuss this in detail in Chapter 5. Perhaps my favorite example of this lesson is the case of Ben Franklin's chess skills. Franklin was America's first famous genius. He was a scientist who made his reputation with his studies of electricity, a popular writer and publisher of Poor Richard's Almanac, the founder of the first public lending library in America, an accomplished diplomat, and the inventor of, among other things, bifocals, the lightning rod, and the Franklin stove. But his greatest passion was chess. He was one of the first chess players in America, and he was a participant in the earliest game of chess known to have been played here. He played chess for more than 50 years, and as he got older, he spent more and more time on it. While in Europe, he played with François-André Danican-Philidor, the best chess player of the time. And despite his well-known advice to be early to bed and early to rise, Franklin regularly played from around 6 p.m. until sunrise. So Ben Franklin was brilliant, and he spent thousands of hours playing chess, sometimes against the best players of the time. Did that make him a great chess player? No. He was above average, but he never got good enough to compare with Europe's better players, much less the best. This failing was a source of great frustration to him, but he had no idea why he couldn't get any better. Today we understand. He never pushed himself, never got out of his comfort zone, never put in the hours of purposeful practice it would take to improve. He was like the pianist playing the same songs the same way for 30 years. That is a recipe for stagnation, not improvement. Getting out of your comfort zone means trying to do something that you couldn't do before. Sometimes you may find it relatively easy to accomplish that new thing, and then you keep pushing on. But sometimes you run into something that stops you cold, and it seems like you'll never be able to do it. Finding ways around these barriers is one of the hidden keys to purposeful practice. Generally, the solution is not to try harder, but rather try differently. It is a technique issue, in other words. In Steve's case, one barrier came when he hit 22 digits. He was grouping them into four-digit groups, which he used various mnemonic tricks to remember, plus a six-digit rehearsal group at the end that he would repeat over and over to himself until he could remember it by the sound of the numbers. But he couldn't figure out how to get past 22 digits, because when he tried to hold five four-digit groups in his head, he became confused about their order. He eventually hit upon the idea of using both three-digit groups and four-digit groups, a breakthrough that eventually allowed him to work up to using four four-digit groups, four three-digit groups, and a six-digit rehearsal group for a maximum of 34 digits. Then, once he reached that limit, he had to develop another technique. This was a regular pattern throughout the entire memory study. Steve would improve up to a point, get stuck, look around for a different approach that could help him get past the barrier, find it, and then improve steadily until another barrier arose. The best way to get past any barrier is to come at it from a different direction, which is one reason it is useful to work with a teacher or coach. Someone who is already familiar with the sorts of obstacles you're likely to encounter can suggest ways to overcome them. And sometimes it turns out that a barrier is more psychological than anything else. The famous violin teacher Dorothy DeLay once described the time that one of her students came to her to help increase his speed on a particular piece that he was scheduled to play at a music festival. He could not play it fast enough, he told her. "How fast," she asked, "would you like to play it?" He answered that he wanted to play it as fast as Itzhak Perlman, the world-famous violinist. So DeLay first got a recording of Perlman playing the piece and timed it. Then she set a metronome to a slow speed and had her student play the piece at that pace, which was well within his abilities. She had him play it again and again, each time speeding up the metronome a bit, and each time he nailed it. Finally, after he'd gone through the piece flawlessly once more, she showed him the setting on the metronome. He had actually played it faster than Perlman. Bill Chase and I used a similar technique with Steve a couple of times when he had hit a barrier and thought he might not be able to improve further. Once, I slowed down the rate at which I read the digits just a bit, and the extra time made it possible for Steve to remember significantly more digits. This convinced him that the problem was not the number of digits, but rather how quickly he was encoding the digits, that is, coming up with the mnemonics for the various groups of digits that made up the entire string, and that he could improve his performance if he could just speed up the time he took to commit the digits to long-term memory. Another time, I gave Steve strings that were 10 digits longer than any of the ones he had managed to remember up to that point. He surprised himself by remembering most of the digits in those strings, and in particular, remembering more total digits than he'd ever done before, even though he wasn't perfect. This convinced him that it was indeed possible to remember longer strings of digits. He realized his problem was not that he had reached the limit of his memory, but rather that he was messing up on one or two groups of digits in the entire string. He decided that the key to moving on was to encode the small groups of digits more carefully, and he began improving again. Whenever you're trying to improve at something, you will run into such obstacles, points at which it seems impossible to progress, or at least where you have no idea what you should do in order to improve. This is natural. What is not natural is a true dead-stop obstacle, one that is impossible to get around, over, or through. In all my years of research, I have found it is surprisingly rare to get clear evidence in any field that a person has reached some immutable limit on performance. Instead, I've found that people more often just give up and stop trying to improve. One caveat here is that while it is always possible to keep going and keep improving, it is not always easy. Maintaining the focus and the effort required by purposeful practice is hard work, and it is generally not fun. So the issue of motivation inevitably comes up. Why do some people engage in this sort of practice? What keeps them going? We will return to these vital questions again and again throughout the book. In Steve's case, there were several factors at work. First, he was getting paid. But he could have always shown up for the sessions and not tried particularly hard and still have gotten paid. So while that may have been part of his motivation, it was certainly not all of it. Why did he push himself so hard to improve? From talking to him, I believe that a large part of it was that once he started to see improvement after the first few sessions, he really enjoyed seeing his memory scores go up. It felt good, and he wanted to keep feeling that way. Also, after he reached a certain level in his memorization abilities, he became something of a celebrity. Stories about him appeared in newspapers and magazines, and he made a number of appearances on television, including the Today Show. This provided another type of positive feedback. Generally speaking, meaningful positive feedback is one of the crucial factors in maintaining motivation. It can be internal feedback, such as the satisfaction of seeing yourself improve at something, or external feedback provided by others. But it makes a huge difference in whether a person will be able to maintain the consistent effort necessary to improve through purposeful practice. One other factor was that Steve liked to challenge himself. This was clear from his record as a cross-country and track runner. Everyone who knew him would tell you that he trained as hard as anyone, but that his motivation was simply to improve his own performance, not necessarily to win races. Furthermore, from years of running, he knew what it meant to train regularly, week after week, month after month, and it seems unlikely that the task of working on his memory 3 times a week for 1 hour each time seemed particularly daunting, given that he regularly went for 3-hour runs. Later, after finishing the memory work with Steve and a couple of other students, I made it a point to recruit only subjects who had trained extensively as athletes, dancers, musicians, or singers. None of them ever quit on me. So here we have purposeful practice in a nutshell. Get outside your comfort zone, but do it in a focused way with clear goals, a plan for reaching those goals, and a way to monitor your progress. Oh, and figure out a way to maintain your motivation. This recipe is an excellent start for anyone who wishes to improve. But it is still just a start. The limits of purposeful practice. While Bill Chase and I were still carrying out our 2-year memory study with Steve Falloon, but after Steve had begun to set records with his digit span memory, we decided to look for another subject who would be willing to take on the same challenge. Neither of us believed that Steve had been born with some special gift for memorizing digits, but rather we assumed that the skills he developed could be attributed completely to the training that he went through. And the best way to prove that was to run the same study with another subject and see if we got the same result. The first person to volunteer was a graduate student, Renee Elio. Before getting started, she was told that her predecessor had dramatically increased the number of digits he could memorize. So she knew such improvement was possible, which was more than Steve had known when he started. But we told Renee nothing about how Steve had done it. She would have to come up with her own approach. When she started out, she improved at a pace that was very similar to Steve's, and she was able to increase her digit span memory to close to 20 digits after about 50 hours of practice sessions. However, unlike Steve, at this point, she hit a wall that she just couldn't get past. After spending another 50 hours or so without improving, she decided to drop out of the training sessions. She had increased her memory for digits to the point that it was far better than any untrained person, and comparable with some mnemonists, but she fell far short of what Steve had accomplished. What was the difference? Steve had succeeded by developing a collection of mental structures, various mnemonics, many of them based on running times, plus a system for keeping track of the order of the mnemonics that allowed him to use his long-term memory to sidestep the usual limitations of short-term memory and remember long strings of digits. When he heard the digits 907, for instance, he conceptualized them as a pretty good 2-mile time, 907 or 9 minutes 7 seconds, and they were no longer random numbers that he had to commit to short-term memory, but rather something he was already familiar with. As we shall see, the key to improved mental performance of almost any sort is the development of mental structures that make it possible to avoid the limitations of short-term memory and deal effectively with large amounts of information at once. Steve had done this. Renee, not knowing how Steve had done it, had developed a completely different approach to memorizing the digits. Where Steve had memorized groups of 3 and 4 digits, mainly in terms of running times, Renee employed an elaborate set of mnemonics that relied on such things as days, dates, and times of day. One key difference between Steve and Renee was that Steve had always decided ahead of time what pattern he would use in memorizing the digits, breaking the strings into 3 and 4-digit sets, plus a group at the end with 4 to 6 digits that he would repeat to himself over and over until he had the sound of it in his memory. For 27 digits, for instance, he would organize the digits into 3 sets of 4 digits each, 3 sets of 3 digits each, and then a 6-digit group at the end. We referred to this prefixed pattern as a retrieval structure, and it allowed Steve to focus on memorizing the 3 and 4-digit sets individually, and then keep in mind where in the retrieval structure each of these individual sets fit. This proved to be a very powerful approach, as it allowed him to encode each set of 3 or 4 digits as a running time, or some other mnemonic, put it in his long-term memory, and then not have to think about it again until he went back at the end to recall all of the digits in the string. Renee, by contrast, devised her mnemonics on the fly, deciding according to the digits she heard what mnemonic she would use to remember them. For a string like 4778245, she might remember it as April 7th, 1978 at 2:45. But if the string was 4778295, she would have to use April 7th, 1978, and then start a new date, February 9th. Without the sort of consistency that Steve's approach offered, she could not master more than 20 digits. After that experience, Bill and I decided to look for another subject who would be as similar to Steve as possible in terms of the way he would memorize the digit strings. Thus, we recruited another runner, Dario Donatelli, a member of the Carnegie Mellon long-distance team and one of Steve's training partners. Steve had told Dario that we were looking for someone who would commit to being a long-term participant in our memory training study, and Dario agreed. This time, instead of letting Dario figure it out for himself, we had Steve teach Dario his method for encoding digits. With his head start, Dario was able to improve much more quickly than Steve had, at least initially. He got to 20 digits in significantly fewer training sessions, but he began to slow down after that, and once he reached 30 digits, it seemed that he was no longer getting much benefit from following Steve's method, and his progress languished. At that point, Dario began developing his own version of Steve's method. He came up with slightly different ways of encoding the strings of 3 and 4 digits, and more importantly, he designed a significantly different retrieval structure that worked much better for him. Still, when we tested how Dario was memorizing the digits, we found that he was relying on mental processes that were very much like the ones that Steve had developed, using long-term memory to sidestep the limitations of short-term memory. After several years of training, Dario would eventually be able to remember more than 100 digits, or about 20 more than Steve. At this point, Dario had become, like Steve before him, the best at this particular skill that the world had ever known. There is an important lesson here. Although it is generally possible to improve to a certain degree with focused practice and staying out of your comfort zone, that's not all there is to it. Trying hard isn't enough. Pushing yourself to your limits isn't enough. There are other equally important aspects to practice and training that are often overlooked. One particular approach to practice and training has proven to be the most powerful and effective way to improve one's abilities in every area that has been studied. This approach is deliberate practice, and we will describe it in detail shortly. But first, we'll take a closer look at what is behind the amazing sorts of improvement that are possible with the right sort of practice. Chapter 2. Harnessing Adaptability. If you're a bodybuilder, or just someone lifting weights to add some muscle, it is easy to track the results as you challenge your biceps, triceps, quadriceps, pecs, delts, lats, traps, abs, glutes, calves, and hamstrings. A tape measure works, or you can simply look in the mirror and admire your progress. If you're running or biking or swimming to increase your endurance, you can track your progress by your heart rate, your breathing, and how long you can keep going until your muscles falter due to lactic acid buildup. But if your challenge is mental, becoming proficient at a calculus, say, or learning how to play a musical instrument or speak a new language, it's different. There is no easy way to observe the resulting changes in your brain as it adapts to the increasing demands being placed on it. There is no soreness in your cortex the day after a particularly tough training session. You don't have to go out and buy new hats because the old ones are now too small. You don't develop a six-pack on your forehead. And because you can't see any changes in your brain, it's easy to assume that there really isn't much going on. That would be a mistake, however. There is a growing body of evidence that both the structure and the function of the brain change in response to various sorts of mental training, in much the same way as your muscles and cardiovascular system respond to physical training. With the help of such brain imaging techniques as magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, neuroscientists have begun to study how the brains of people with particular skills differ from the brains of people without those skills, and to explore which sorts of training produce which types of changes. Although there is still a tremendous amount to learn in this area, we already know enough to have a clear idea of how purposeful practice and deliberate practice work to increase both our physical and mental capabilities, and make it possible to do things that we never could before. Much of what we know about how the body adapts to training comes from studies of runners, weightlifters, and various other athletes. Interestingly enough, however, some of the best studies to date of how the brain changes in response to extended training were carried out not with musicians or chess players or mathematicians. Some of the more traditional subjects in studies of the effects of practice on performance, but instead with taxi drivers. The brains of London cabbies. Few cities in the world can baffle a GPS system like London can. To start with, there is no grid of thoroughfares that can be used for orientation and routing, as you will find in Manhattan or Paris or Tokyo. Instead, the city's major streets are set at odd angles to each other. They curve and they squiggle. One-way streets abound. There are traffic circles and dead ends all over. And through the middle of everything runs the Thames River, spanned by a dozen bridges in central London, at least one of which, and sometimes more, will likely have to be crossed during a trip of any length through the city. And the erratic numbering system doesn't always tell you exactly where to find a particular address, even when you've found the right street. Thus, the best advice for visitors is to forget about renting a car with a navigational system and instead rely on the city's cabbies. They're ubiquitous, some 25,000 of them, driving around in their big, black, boxy cars that are the automotive equivalent of sensible shoes, and they are astonishingly good at getting you from point A to point B in the most efficient way possible, taking into account not only the lengths of the various possible paths, but the time of day, the expected traffic, temporary road work and road closings, and any other details that might be relevant to the trip. Nor do points A and B have to be traditional street addresses. Suppose you'd like to revisit that funky little hat shop in Charing Cross whose name you don't quite recall, Lord's or Lear or something like that, but you do remember that there's a little shop next door that sells cupcakes. Well, that will be enough. Tell all that to your cabbie, and as soon as is automotively possible, you will find yourself in front of Laird London, 23A New Row. As you might imagine, given the challenges of finding one's way in London, not just anyone can be a cabbie. Indeed, to become a licensed London taxi driver, one must pass a series of examinations that have been described as, collectively, the most difficult test in the world. The test is administered by Transport for London, and that agency describes the knowledge, what a prospective driver must learn, as follows. To achieve the required standard to be licensed as an all-London taxi driver, you will need a thorough knowledge, primarily of the area within a 6-mile radius of Charing Cross. You will need to know all the streets, housing estates, parks and open spaces, government offices and departments, financial and commercial centers, diplomatic premises, town halls, registry offices, hospitals, places of worship, sports stadiums and leisure centers, airline offices, stations, hotels, clubs, theaters, cinemas, museums, art galleries, schools, colleges and universities, police stations and headquarters buildings, civil, criminal, and coroner's courts, prisons, and places of interest to tourists. In fact, anywhere a taxi passenger might ask to be taken. That area, within 6 miles of Charing Cross, contains approximately 25,000 streets. But a prospective cabbie must be familiar with more than just streets and buildings. Any landmark is fair game. According to a 2014 story about London taxi drivers in the New York Times Magazine, one prospective driver was asked about the location of a statue of two mice with a piece of cheese. The statue, on the facade of a building, was just 1 foot tall. More to the point, prospective taxi drivers must demonstrate that they can get from one point in the city to another as efficiently as possible. Tests consist of a series of runs in which the examiner gives 2 points in London, and the examinee must provide the precise location of each of the points and then describe the best route between them, turn by turn, naming each street in the sequence. Each run earns a numerical score based on its accuracy. And as the prospective driver accumulates points, the tests get harder and harder, with the end points becoming more obscure and the routes longer, more complicated, and more convoluted. Half or more of the prospective drivers end up dropping out. But those who stay with it and earn their licenses have internalized London to a degree that Google Maps, with its satellite images, camera cars, and unfathomable memory and processing power, can only vaguely approximate. To master the knowledge, prospective cabbies, who are known as knowledge boys and occasionally knowledge girls, spend years driving from place to place in London, making notes of what is where and how to get from here to there. The first step is to master a list of 320 runs in the guidebook provided to taxi driver candidates. For a given run, a candidate will generally first figure out the shortest route by physically traveling the various possible routes, usually by motorbike, and then will explore the areas around the beginning and the end of each run. This means wandering within a quarter mile or so of each of those places, taking notes on which buildings and which landmarks are in the vicinity. After having repeated this process 320 times, the prospective cabbie has accumulated a foundational set of 320 best routes around London, and has also explored and taken notes on pretty much every bit of the core area within 6 miles of Charing Cross. It is a start. But successful candidates keep challenging themselves to determine the best routes for many other runs that are not on the list, and to take notes of buildings and landmarks that they might have missed before, or that might have recently appeared. Indeed, after even passing all the tests and getting licensed, London taxi drivers continue to increase and hone their knowledge of London streets. The resulting memory and navigational skills are nothing short of astonishing. And so London taxi drivers have proved irresistible to psychologists interested in learning, and particularly in the learning of navigational skills. By far the most in-depth studies of the cabbies, and the ones that have the most to tell us about how training affects the brain, have been carried out by Eleanor Maguire, a neuroscientist at University College London. In one of her earliest works on the taxi drivers, published in 2000, Maguire used magnetic resonance imaging to look at the brains of 16 male taxi drivers and compare them with the brains of 50 other males of similar ages who were not taxi drivers. She looked in particular at the hippocampus, that seahorse-shaped part of the brain involved in the development of memories. The hippocampus is particularly engaged by spatial navigation and in remembering the location of things in space. Each person actually has two hippocampi, one on each side of the brain. For instance, species of birds that store food in different places and thus must be able to remember the location of these various caches have relatively larger hippocampi than closely related birds that don't store food in different places. More to the point, the size of the hippocampus is quite flexible in at least some species of birds, and can grow by as much as 30% in response to a bird's food-storing experiences. But would the same thing be true in humans? Maguire found that a particular part of the hippocampus, the posterior or rear part, was larger in the taxi drivers than in the other subjects. Furthermore, the more time that a person had spent as a taxi driver, the larger the posterior hippocampi were. In another study that Maguire carried out a few years later, she compared the brains of London taxi drivers with London bus drivers. Like the taxi drivers, the bus drivers spent their days driving around London. The difference between them was that the bus drivers repeated the same routes over and over, and thus never had to figure out the best way to get from point A to point B. Maguire found that the posterior hippocampi of the taxi drivers were significantly larger than the same parts of the brain in the bus drivers. The clear implication was that whatever was responsible for the difference in the size of the posterior hippocampi was not related to the driving itself, but rather was related specifically to the navigational skills that the job required. That still left one loose end, however. Perhaps the taxi drivers in the studies had started out with larger posterior hippocampi that gave them an advantage in finding their way around London, and the extensive testing they went through was nothing more than a weeding out process that zeroed in on those prospective drivers who were naturally better equipped to be able to learn their way around the maze that is London. Maguire addressed this issue quite simply and powerfully. She followed a group of prospective taxi drivers from the time they started training for their licenses until the point at which all of them had either passed the tests and become licensed cabbies or else had given up and gone on to do something else. In particular, she recruited 79 prospective drivers, all of them male, who were just starting training, as well as another 31 males of similar ages to serve as controls. When she scanned all their brains, she found no difference in the sizes of the posterior hippocampi between the prospective drivers and the controls. 4 years later, she revisited the two groups of subjects. By this time, 41 of the trainees had become licensed London taxi drivers, while 38 had stopped training or failed their tests. So at this point, there were three groups to compare. The new taxi drivers, who had learned enough about London streets to pass the series of tests, the trainees who had not learned enough to pass, and the group who had not ever trained at all. Once again, Maguire scanned their brains and calculated the size of the posterior hippocampi in each. What she found would have been no surprise if she had been measuring biceps and bodybuilders, but she wasn't. She was measuring the size of different parts of the brain, and so the result was startling. The volume of the posterior hippocampi had gotten significantly larger in the group of trainees who had continued their training and had become licensed taxi drivers. By contrast, there was no change in the size of the posterior hippocampi among the prospective taxi drivers who had failed to become licensed, either because they simply stopped training or because they could not pass the tests, or among the subjects who had never had anything to do with the taxi training program. The years spent mastering the knowledge had enlarged precisely that part of the brain that is responsible for navigating from one place to another. McGuire's study, which was published in 2011, is perhaps the most dramatic evidence we have that the human brain grows and changes in response to intense training. Furthermore, the clear implication of her study is that the extra neurons and other tissue in the posterior hippocampi of the licensed cabbies underlie their increased navigational capabilities. You can think about the posterior hippocampi of a London taxi driver as the neural equivalent of the massively developed arms and shoulders of a male gymnast. Years of work on the rings and pommel horse and parallel bars and floor exercises have built muscles that are exquisitely suited for the sorts of movements he performs on those different pieces of apparatus, and indeed that make it possible for him to do all sorts of gymnastics moves that were simply not within his reach when he began training. The posterior hippocampi of the taxi drivers are equally bulked up, but with brain tissue, not muscle fiber. Adaptability. Until the first decade of the 21st century, most scientists would have flat out denied that something like what McGuire has seen in the brains of London cabbies was even possible. The general belief was that once a person reached adulthood, the wiring of his or her brain was pretty much fixed. Sure, everyone understood that there had to be tweaks here and there when you learned something new, but these were thought to be little more than the strengthening of some neural connections and the weakening of others, because the overall structure of the brain and its various neural networks were fixed. This idea went hand in hand with the belief that individual differences in abilities were due mainly to genetically determined differences in the brain's wiring, and that learning was just a way of fulfilling one's genetic potential. One common metaphor depicted the brain as a computer. Learning was like loading some data or installing new software. It allowed you to do some things you couldn't do before, but your ultimate performance would always be limited by such things as the number of bytes in your random access memory, RAM, and the power of your central processing unit, CPU. By contrast, the body's adaptability has always been easier to recognize, as we've noted. One of my favorite examples of physical adaptability involves push-ups. If you're a relatively fit male in your 20s, you may be able to do 40 or 50. If you can do 100, you can impress your friends and probably win a few bets. So, what might you guess is the world record for push-ups? 500 or 1,000? In 1980, Minoru Yoshida of Japan did 10,507 push-ups non-stop. After that, Guinness World Records stopped accepting submissions for the number of push-ups done with no rest periods and switched to the most push-ups performed in 24 hours with resting allowed. In 1993, Charles Servizio of the United States set what remains the world record in that category by doing 46,001 push-ups in 21 hours and 21 minutes. Or consider pull-ups. Even relatively fit guys can generally do only 10 or 15. Although if you've really been working out, you may have worked your way up to 40 or 50. In 2014, Jan Karasch of the Czech Republic did 4,654 in 12 hours. In short, the human body is incredibly adaptable. It is not just the skeletal muscles, but also the heart, the lungs, the circulatory system, the body's energy stores, and more. Everything that goes into physical strength and stamina. There may be limits, but there is no indication that we have reached them yet. From McGuire's work, and that of others, we're now learning that the brain has a very similar degree and variety of adaptability. Some of the earliest observations of this sort of adaptability, or plasticity, as neuroscientists would say, appeared in studies of how the brains of blind or deaf people rewire themselves to find new uses for the parts of the brain that are normally dedicated to processing sights or sounds, but that in these people have nothing to do. Most blind people cannot see because of problems with their eyes or optic nerve. but the visual cortex and other parts of the brain are still fully functional. They're just not getting any input from the eyes. If the brain actually were hardwired like a computer, these visual regions would sit forever idle. We now know, however, that the brain reroutes some of its neurons so that these otherwise unused areas are put to work doing other things, particularly things related to the remaining senses, which blind people must rely on to get information about their surroundings. To read, for example, the blind run their fingertips over the raised dots that make up the Braille alphabet. When researchers use MRI machines to watch the brains of blind subjects as they read words in Braille, one of the parts of the brain that they see lighting up is the visual cortex. In people with normal sight, the visual cortex would light up in response to input from the eyes, not the fingertips. But in the blind, the visual cortex helps them interpret the fingertip sensations they get from brushing over the groups of raised dots that make up the Braille letters. Interestingly enough, it is not just otherwise unused areas of the brain where rewiring occurs. If you practice something enough, your brain will repurpose neurons to help with the task, even if they already have another job to do. Perhaps the most compelling evidence of this comes from an experiment done in the late 1990s, when a group of researchers examined the parts of the brain that controlled various fingers on the hands of a group of highly skilled Braille readers. The subjects were three-fingered Braille readers. That is, they used their index fingers to read the patterns of dots that make up the individual letters, their middle fingers to pick out the spaces between the letters, and their ring fingers to keep track of the particular line they were reading. The wiring in the part of the brain that controls the hands is normally set up so that each individual finger has a distinct part of the brain dedicated to it. This is what makes it possible for us to tell, for example, which fingertip is being touched by a pencil tip or a thumbtack without looking at our fingers. The subjects in the study were Braille instructors who used their fingers to read Braille several hours each day. What the researchers discovered was that this steady use of the three fingers had caused the areas of the brain devoted to each of those fingers to grow so much that those areas eventually overlapped. As a result, the subjects were exceptionally sensitive to touch on these fingers. They could detect a much gentler touch than sighted subjects. But they often couldn't tell which of the three fingers had been touched. These studies of brain plasticity in blind subjects, and similar studies in deaf subjects, tell us that the brain's structure and function are not fixed. They change in response to use. It is possible to shape the brain, your brain, my brain, anybody's brain, in the ways that we desire through conscious, deliberate training. Researchers are just beginning to explore the various ways that this plasticity can be put to work. One of the most striking results to date could have implications for anyone who suffers from age-related farsightedness, which is just about everyone over the age of 50. The study, which was carried out by American and Israeli neuroscientists and vision researchers, was reported in 2012. Those scientists assembled a group of middle-aged volunteers, all of whom had difficulty focusing on nearby objects. The official name of the condition is presbyopia, and it results from a problem with the eye itself, which loses elasticity in its lens, making it more difficult to focus well enough to make out small details. There is also an associated difficulty in detecting contrasts between light and dark areas, which exacerbates the difficulty in focusing. The consequences are a boon for optometrists and opticians, and a bother for the over 50 crowd, nearly all of whom need glasses to read or perform close-up work. The researchers had their subjects come into the lab three or so times a week for 3 months and spend 30 minutes each visit training their vision. The subjects were asked to spot a small image against a background that was very similar in shade to the spot. That is, there was very little contrast between the image and the background. Spotting these images required intense concentration and effort. Over time, the subjects learned to more quickly and accurately determine the presence of these images. At the end of 3 months, the subjects were tested to see what size type they could read. On average, they were able to read letters that were 60% smaller than they could at the beginning of the training, and every single subject had improved. Furthermore, after the training, every subject was able to read a newspaper without glasses, something a majority of them couldn't do beforehand. They were also able to read faster than before. Surprisingly, none of this improvement was caused by changes in the eyes, which had the same stiffness and difficulty focusing as before. Instead, the improvement was due to changes in the part of the brain that interprets visual signals from the eye. Although the researchers couldn't pinpoint exactly what those changes were, they believe that the brain learned to de-blur images. Blurry images result from a combination of two different weaknesses in vision: an inability to see small details and difficulties in detecting differences in contrast. And both of these issues can be helped by the image processing carried out in the brain, in much the same way that the image processing software of a computer or a camera can sharpen an image by such techniques as manipulating the contrast. The researchers who carried out the study believe that their training exercises taught the subjects' brains to do a better job of processing, which in turn allowed the subjects to discern smaller details without any improvement in the signal from the eyes. Challenging homeostasis. Why should the human body and brain be so adaptable in the first place? It all stems, ironically enough, from the fact that the individual cells and tissues try to keep everything the same as much as possible. The human body has a preference for stability. It maintains a steady internal temperature. It keeps a stable blood pressure and heart rate. It keeps the blood glucose levels and pH balance, acidity to alkalinity level, steady. It maintains a reasonably constant weight from day to day. None of these things are completely static, of course. Pulse rate increases with exercise, for instance, and body weight goes up or down with overeating or dieting. But these changes are usually temporary, and the body eventually gets back to where it was. The technical term for this is homeostasis, which simply refers to the tendency of a system, any sort of system, but most often a living creature or some part of a living creature, to act in a way that maintains its own stability. Individual cells like stability as well. They maintain a certain level of water and also regulate the balance of positive and negative ions, particularly sodium and potassium ions, and various small molecules by controlling which ions and molecules stay and which exit through the cell membrane. More important to us is the fact that cells require a stable environment if they are to function effectively. If the surrounding tissues get too hot or too cold, if their fluid level moves too far outside of the preferred range, if the oxygen level drops too far, or if the energy supplies get too low, it damages the functioning of the cells. If the changes are too big for too long, the cells start to die. Thus, the body is equipped with various feedback mechanisms that act to maintain the status quo. Consider what happens when you engage in some sort of vigorous physical activity. The contraction of muscle fibers causes the individual muscle cells to expend their supplies of energy and oxygen, which are replenished from nearby blood vessels. But now the level of oxygen and energy supplies in the bloodstream drops, which leads the body to take various measures in response. The breathing rate goes up to increase oxygen levels in the blood and to clear out more carbon dioxide. Various energy stores are converted into the sort of energy supply that the muscles can use and feed into the bloodstream. Meanwhile, blood circulation increases in order to better distribute the oxygen and energy supplies to those parts of the body that need them. As long as the physical exercise is not so strenuous that it strains the body's homeostatic mechanisms, the exercise will do very little to prompt physical changes in the body. From the body's perspective, there is no reason to change. Everything is working as it should. It's a different matter when you engage in a sustained, vigorous physical activity that pushes the body beyond the point where the homeostatic mechanisms can compensate. Your body's systems and cells find themselves in abnormal states, with abnormally low levels of oxygen and various energy-related compounds, such as glucose, adenosine diphosphate, ADP, and adenosine triphosphate, ATP. The metabolism of the various cells can no longer proceed as usual, so there are different sets of biochemical reactions going on in the cells, producing an entirely different suite of biochemical products than the cell usually produces. The cells are not happy with this altered state of affairs, and they respond by calling up some different genes from the cell's DNA. Most of the genes in the DNA of a cell are inactive at any given time, and the cell will switch on and switch off various genes, depending on what it needs at the time. These newly activated genes will switch on or ramp up various biochemical systems within the cell, which will change its behavior in ways that are intended to respond to the fact that the cells and surrounding systems have been pushed out of their comfort zone. The exact details of what goes on inside a cell in response to such stresses are extremely complicated, and researchers are only just now beginning to unravel them. For example, in one study on rats, the scientists conducting the study counted 112 different genes that were turned on when the workload on a particular muscle in the rear legs of the rats was sharply increased. Judging by the particular genes that were switched on, the response included such things as a change in the metabolism of the muscle cells, changes in their structure, and a change in the rate at which new muscle cells were formed. The eventual result of all these changes was a strengthening of the rats' muscles so that they could handle the increased workload. They had been pushed out of their comfort zone, and the muscles responded by getting strong enough to establish a new comfort zone. The homeostasis had been reestablished. This is the general pattern for how physical activity creates changes in the body. When a body system, certain muscles, the cardiovascular system, or something else, is stressed to the point that homeostasis can no longer be maintained, the body responds with changes that are intended to reestablish homeostasis. Suppose, for example, that you begin a program of aerobic exercise, say jogging 3 times a week for 30 minutes each time, keeping your heart rate at the recommended level of 70% of your maximum heart rate, which works out to something over 140 beats per minute for younger adults. The sustained activity will, among other things, lead to low levels of oxygen in the capillaries that supply your leg muscles. Your body will respond by growing new capillaries in order to provide more oxygen to the muscle cells in your legs and return them to their comfort zone. This is how your body's desire for homeostasis can be harnessed to drive changes. Push it hard enough and for long enough, and it will respond by changing in ways that make that push easier to do. You will have gotten a little stronger, built a little more endurance, developed a little more coordination. But there is a catch. Once the compensatory changes have occurred, new muscle fibers have grown and become more efficient, new capillaries have grown, and so on, the body can handle the physical activity that had previously stressed it. It is comfortable again. The changes stop. So to keep the changes happening, you have to keep upping the ante. Run farther, run faster, run uphill. If you don't keep pushing and pushing and pushing some more, the body will settle into homeostasis, albeit at a different level than before, and you will stop improving. This explains the importance of staying just outside your comfort zone. You need to continually push to keep the body's compensatory changes coming. But if you push too far outside your comfort zone, you risk injuring yourself and actually setting yourself back. This, at least, is the way the body responds to physical activity. The scientists know much less about how the brain changes in response to mental challenges. One major difference between the body and the brain is that the cells in the adult brain do not generally divide and form new brain cells. There are a few exceptions, such as in the hippocampus, where new neurons can grow. But in most parts of the brain, the changes that occur in response to a mental challenge, such as the contrast training used to improve people's vision, won't include the development of new neurons. Instead, the brain rewires those networks in various ways, by strengthening or weakening the various connections between neurons, and also by adding new connections or getting rid of old ones. There can also be an increase in the amount of myelin, the insulating sheath that forms around nerve cells and allows nerve signals to travel more quickly. Myelination can increase the speed of nerve impulses by as much as 10 times. Because these networks of neurons are responsible for thought, memories, controlling movement, interpreting sensory signals,